Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us the NASDAQ 100 hit a record high, and he also notes what has been behind the recent rapid rise in the markets. Ross checks out crude, gold, the U.S. and Canadian dollars. InsideTrackTrading.com President Eric Haddock examines the cycles that affect the stock markets, gold, silver, bonds, and crude. He also warns that we might see some shocking effects from a peak in solar flares and sunspots next year. Publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, Robert Campbell, talks to us from San Diego about what he uses to predict the real estate market. He says real estate is peaking in the U.S. overall, while California continues to see an exodus of people. He tells us why people are fleeing the Golden State. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Ross, just how did the markets fare this week? I understand the NASDAQ 100 really had a good week.
Yeah, we've got these indices have been just rocking and rolling here since the end of October. You got the NASDAQ at new record high closes. We take a look along here. The various indices are up anywhere, the broad ones, from 15 to 18% since the October low. So pretty dramatic move, and that's been without corrections along the way. We had one pause about 10 days ago and then took off again. The big leader, though, off the bottom was the Russell 2000. It's up about 24% just here in this last 6 weeks. It was the sort of the underdog and had been just flirting around the supporting lows for a number of, months, but it's much longer than that. So it's come to life, had a big rally, and seasonally, small caps typically will do well in this end-of-the-year stretch into the early part of January, so not out of line. The thing that this has done, though, just at the tail end of this week, we've got just a whole series of overbought signals. And this is the type of thing we don't see every day in terms of the type of signals that are out there. The one that is on the Dow, we haven't seen that now since the better part of, you got to go back to 2017, 2018 top to find anything that's overbought. So for all that we might have a little bit more to go on the upside, I think a correction, a hiccup right now would just be the ideal thing to happen. And then, that could be, before the end of the year, then a rally up into January is part of the seasonal move and might get a larger correction out of January. So that's the overall look that we've got here. You know, the biggest leaders in the whole bunch have been things like the home builders. You got Lennar's up 50%, D.R. Horton up 50%, Pulte up 50%. This group, just out of the October lows, has been big, big move. Got an extra boost this week when the Fed chairman, Powell, we started to hear about maybe a cap on rates now, lower rates next year. The dot plots added a little bit to that.
Mm-hmm. What's going on with gold?
Well, gold has just been reacting the way we were looking for. A week ago, we had we were in the process of selling off from the all-time highs, and on the Friday and Monday of a week back, we got good oversold signals and put out report for clients to buy the dip. It was just a perfect move, and look for a 38% to 50% retracement rally of the decline. We got that right into Thursday, so it's been a nice move there. Ideally, we might go back and test the lows that we saw a week ago, build a bit of a base support there, and then be ready for an additional move to the upside. And, you know, silver, which had done really well coming off the bottom, probably does the same type of thing. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it pop through the best levels that we had this year.
What's happening with crude?
Crude oil had been looking for the seasonal bottom, and it had been stair-stepping its way down. We have we had a support in the early part of the week, bounced off of that, then broke it, and then came back, closing up through 72 in midweek. And the reversal that we've been looking for appears to now be in place. And the next thing we would be looking for is a sustained move on the upside in February and possibly into April. So the complex, maybe not heating oil, but the complex in terms of energies is just poised for a nice move off this bottom.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, the move to not do anything on interest rates. You know, the Fed's data dependent, just like we are when we take a look at our charts. The move by the Fed it now appears that the hike in rates is over. So, guess what? U.S. dollar took just a bit of a dip here. Putting it mildly. The action was fairly big. We ended up, we've been in this last week and a half from 104 down to 102, and then we got a bounce. So probably see some action here with resistance probably in the 103 and a quarter, 103 and a half level, but trending down and testing the lows again.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Eric Haddock next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money and best of the season.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim, and best of the season to you as well.
Eric, stocks reacted sharply to Wednesday's Fed news and have been closely adhering to your roadmap for November, December. What are the next phases of that outlook?
I have been on a intermediate basis discussing an overall outlook from late October when multi-month, multi-week cycles bottomed in most of the stock indexes, and then they subsequently gave some 1 to 2 month buy signals right in there. Until I think those cycles will peak in January, And just the way a lot of the timing indicators were set up, it was showing me that we should see an initial rally from late October into late November, then a little bit of a pause in late November, early December, then another rally up into middle of December, the 3 days of December 14th, 15th, and 18th, three trading days, are the greatest synergy of my daily cycles when I expect a second higher peak. And then another pause and setback in after mid-December, and then a final rally up into January. So we're right in that phase where we're coming into a top. The Fed news could be a perfect buy the rumor, sell the fact type of thing, where you get the markets moving up into that news, and then you get a kind of a final blow off spike high on the very positive perception of Powell's discussions, announcements, and the idea, or the more specific expectation that there will be probably three rate cuts in 2024. So I think you've got stocks running up into a peak, and we'll probably get a setback from then and one final rally into January. And then that's when some more turbulent and precarious cycles come into play in the equity markets and in some of the other key markets.
When we last talked, you described why November 13th should usher in a bullish move in gold and silver. You wrote about a gold surge you expected to last into December 4th and test 2150. Can you update that outlook?
Yes, gold and silver have really been, to me, setting up for a major advance. And, you know, up until this time, I've been trying to really take a conservative view on gold and silver because I thought they were going through a correction and basing process in 2021, 2022. But when we saw major cycles project another multi-year low in late 2022, among other things, there's been a very consistent seven-year cycle in gold and silver that has timed major multi-year lows back in late 2015, late 2008, late 2001, and again it came into play in late 2022, and that's when I thought we would see a multi-year low. But subsequent to that, there were a couple of times in 2023 when I thought we would see strong surges in gold and silver. The first one being in March through May, and the second one being in the fourth quarter here. And to me, they are kind of precursor events, that they're confirming that this major low is intact and that we're starting to show signs of acceleration to the upside, starting to turn some longer-term indicators positive, starting to break through some key indicators and key resistance levels. And so what I was describing in my publication throughout November was that everything showed me we should see an accelerated rally into what I listed was December 4th as the greatest synergy of cycles and timing indicators, and that gold should spike up to 2152. That was the exact number for the February gold that I had published in the weeks leading into that. Lo and behold, we rallied, spiked higher into December 4th. Gold peaked at 2152.60 and then saw a sharp sell-off from there. But that to me is only just another correction, because the other thing I explained with that was that we should see the first sharp rally into that early December time frame, but then a subsequent rally from mid-December into into January when some more significant cycles peak, but that there were certain indicators starting to turn very positive and setting up for an accelerated rally in not only in the metals, but in the mining shares during this, really the indicator that I'm following, what I call my MAC, weekly 21 MAC and monthly 21 MAC, they possess the greatest potential for a reversal and the initiation of a sharp rally in the week before mid-December, so the current week, December 11th to the 15th, and then next week, the 18th to the 22nd. And so you've got some things working in gold and silver's favor, and I think that that the Fed news is another affirmation of what you and I have talked about a couple times in the last few months, what I term the sweet spot for silver and for gold within an inflationary cycle. And it's that period of time when you still have plenty of inflation in the market, but you've now removed the biggest weight or burden on gold and silver, and that is the fear of consistent rate hikes. So you've got the inflationary part still supporting gold and silver, and now you're removing the thing that has kept them under wraps. It's almost kind of been like a compressing spring here throughout 2022-2023, where that ceiling from the fear of higher interest rates, which is negative for gold and silver, that's been keeping a ceiling on them. And now it was already being removed, but the Fed news and announcement kind of makes it clear that's their plan, that their perception, that the even if they change what they think about rate cuts, the potential for any additional rate hikes on the horizon has been removed from their thinking, and so you've got this sweet spot where it's the most beneficial for gold and silver. But there's other factors and other indicators that need to confirm that. And adding to that, you also have just on December 8th, my work triggered some pretty convincing buy signals in platinum. And so my work described a trading strategy there, a buy signal to begin this week. We're starting to get into long positions on December 11th in the expectation that even platinum is getting ready for a pretty strong surge. So it's one of those things where now you're starting to get all of the metals agreeing, which is consistent with what I'm describing about that whole sweet spot from an economic and a financial standpoint that I think is really going to help gold and silver in the coming weeks and months. And there's a couple other things that I think will certainly play in their favor. Just some of the unusual events that I think we could see between in late 2023 to late 2024, even like what I've been describing in my newsletters about my perception of solar storm and sunspot cycles. And I think we've just entered the time in fourth quarter of 2023 through the fourth quarter of 2024 when all of my work shows the greatest potential for some disruptive solar storms.
Wow, so like the Carrington event in the mid-1800s?
Well, that's the extreme. That's the granddaddy of them all, the Carrington event in 1859, I believe it was. But you've had on a very consistent 17-year cycle basis, on a very consistent 11 and 22-year cycle basis, which those two cycles are linked to sunspots, on a broader overriding cycle, very consistent storms come about. And 2023, late 2023 to late 2024 is when almost all of those divergent and not unrelated, but diverse cycles all converge, all collide during this time frame in my work. And I've been writing about it throughout this year. In fact, there's several reports we send out to our new subscribers. One I wrote back in May of this year, and I called it Solar Seismic and Silver Cycles, because there's also a volcanic cycle connected to that as well. That's where the seismic comes from. Back in January, I started out explaining why I thought we would be entering the year of disruption, I called it. And even in late 2022, when I was writing about the Middle East war cycles that I expected to come back into play in late 2023, I explained how often those things are a reflection of disturbances that on a conscious level we're not even necessarily aware of. And this is not to get way into some esoteric or metaphysical or mystical type of thing, but that there are and have been documented many of these time frames when there's instability. There's geophysical instability, there's solar instability, and you look at the things that have occurred on Earth during those times, and it's been fairly consistent that you have seen markets and socioeconomic reactions to those events on a consistent basis. So again, I'm not going right to a sky is falling, it's going to be the Carrington event again. But, you know, in 1989, you had the Quebec solar storm that knocked out a chunk of their power grid and during the winter. And in fact, there are a couple of kind of intermediary buffer power stations throughout the grid that had that, I think that was the storm, where had they not held up as they did, it could have reverberated all the way down the east coast of the U.S. And you had the Bastille Day storm back in, I think it was 2002 or 2003. Funny enough, exactly 11 years ago in 2012, and 11 years is the average time frame between sunspot peaks and sunspot troughs, but you had one of the largest solar storms, explosion sunspots that they have mapped or documented. And it was only because of about a five-day lag between the sun's rotation that entire CME, coronal mass ejection, just went out into space instead of heading towards Earth. And so the sun has a lot of sunspots, but it depends on how it's turned and whether those sunspots are facing and potentially targeting Earth, or they're shooting off into space. But like I said, you've had these very consistent cycles, and that's why in my work I've just been describing why this late 2023 to late 2024 period is when I see the greatest convergence of all these different cycles that I've observed and have documented. And I've tried to kind of lay them out in a very detailed fashion. So it's, again, not something that someone might perceive as just some mystical idea that I have in my mind.
How does the Fed news and expectations for 3 interest rate cuts in 2024 factor into your outlook? And does that reinforce your outlook for bonds?
I think what they released and what they discussed is a perfect affirmation of this four-year cycle that I've described in bonds and why all of my work was showing a major bottom for October of 2023 and that the next significant top I don't expect to take hold until July of 2024. That's consistent with this four-year cycle that I've described to you before, where you've seen a peak in bonds and a corresponding low in the related interest rates. Every 4 years, it was what really helped me pinpoint the peak in bonds back in July of 2020, which was 4 years from the penultimate peak in July of 2016, which was 4 years from a preceding peak in July of 2012. It's a very consistent cycle and periodicity in bonds. And in order for that to be validated again, I needed to see bonds bottom here in October, which was linked to many other cycles that have timed lows in bonds, and then see them start to give some bullish signals, which they gave in November and the first week of December. One of the key things I look for is a trend indicator that helps me confirm reversals. And so the weekly trend turned up on December 1st, and that confirmed to me that a multi-month bottom is in place. And when we just got this Fed fundamental confirmation of that scenario, that fits perfectly with the idea that bonds are poised for a rebound into the middle of next year. So I do think as we go through this mid-December period that we're in the process of probably completing the first rally in bonds, probably get a little bit of consolidation after the surge following Fed news. Again, another example of buy the rumor, sell the news type of thing. And when I say sell the news, it's more create an initial top, not selling short on something like that, but it's time to maybe lighten up a few of the longs that you've had going into that peak. But I think that you've got this overall outlook that was reinforced by that news, that bonds are in a basing period and that they should see a steady rebound into the middle part of next year.
In our last interview, you described how crude needed to spike down to $70 a barrel before a low likely would take hold. That appears to be happening now. Is a bottom forming?
I do think that crude is putting in at least an intermediate low. I had several intermediate weekly and monthly cycles coming into play last week, December 4th to the 8th, and the current week, December 11th to the 15th, when if crude was able to spike down below $70 and we just got that spike low, I think it even spiked a little below 69 briefly. I'm watching the March crude futures contract as my focus for this analysis. And so we just got that, and I do think that we're going to see a rally in crude, and even that could benefit from the interest rate perception, just that it's, you know, something that could help a little bit of a recovery in demand looking out over the coming weeks or months. But I think there's other factors impacting crude that show me we should see at least a multi-week bottom here. I've also described the correlation between that and the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, which is certainly an index of many commodities, but it's heavily weighted in energy, just like our entire economy is. And that has been, both crude and the GSCI have been telling me to look for a sharp correction beginning in mid-September, ending by the middle of December, and then a sizable rebound from that, and we've just hit some support points. So I do think that crude is setting a little bit of a low here. That is a tradable rebound coming.
What about the overall commodity markets and indexes?
I think, like I was just saying, with the GSCI and some of your other commodity indexes, I think that you have seen some significant sell-offs in a lot of commodities, your livestock markets, even some of your softs recently, as well as energy. And that I do think we're coming into a bottoming phase here. And I think in many respects, 2024 could have some surprise moves in certain key commodities. And while I think that most of that is related to their individual fundamentals and climate, growing seasons, precipitation, whatever it may be, I do think that this potential for some surprise events over the coming year could play a role in that as well. In fact, one of the things I was just pulling it up here on my desk when I was describing in my December Inside Track newsletter, I was just describing how a lot of these markets reflect the instability, kind of what I was already saying to you. But the way I put it in my newsletter was that that you've got a lot of these factors all coming, even the Middle East war cycles that are starting to erupt is a reflection of other forces that we may not always see or identify. And as I put it in my December newsletter, I said the return of the 22-year cycle of Middle East upheaval is likely a harbinger of a related intensification of actual sunspots and solar storms that have been forecast to spike in late 2023 through late 2024. Mass psychological instability on Earth is often a reflection of underlying instability below the surface, and in parentheses, tectonic instability, and outside our atmosphere, solar instability. Since this has long been the time projected to see a surge in solar and volcanic eruptions, this geopolitical instability fits perfect. And gold is corroborating as it steadily validates analysis for a breakout surge. That was written a couple weeks ago. But it just reinforced all of these other reports and analysis that I have been stressing throughout this year, that late 2023 through late 2024 was what I thought would be an unstable time in many respects, and I think that the commodity markets are going to reflect that as well.
Eric, before we go, can you tell us a little bit about InsideTrackTrading.com?
Yes, InsideTrackTrading is our advisory service, which also seeks to be educational in nature, informational, a little bit enlightening, especially when I delve into some of these less recognized or observed cycles. And we provide, we offer different subscription services and publications. As I mentioned, we've got several of these special reports that we send out to new subscribers that I think some of them are going to be very timely in the coming weeks and months. And there are a lot of archived reports and samples on our website. And you can contact us through the website to get additional samples and information about our subscriptions.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money, and best of the season.
Thank you, Jim. Have a great weekend.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. Coming up, Robert Campbell, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY. On the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money, and happy holidays.
Yeah, thank you, Jim.
When will the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter come out?
It'll come out in January 15th, 2024, next year.
Does your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, look at times of rising interest rates and constricting credit?
Yes, it does. Interestingly, that interest rates is one of my five key indicators that I use, that I presented in the book, that you should follow on a regular basis, because they're reliable indicators of what the housing market's going to do, which way prices are going to go next. And the least predictive is interest rates, interestingly. So they have value to follow, but that, as far as predicting, you know, as a leading indicator, they're the least predictive, because what often happens with interest rates is that they go down during a falling market and go up during a rising market. Where interest rates really become important is that when the trend of the market is up and interest rates start falling, it's like a shot of adrenaline into the market. So they do have value, but as far as a priority of things to follow, the other four key indicators that I present in my book are far more valuable for predicting future price direction, and those are existing home sales, new home building permits, mortgage defaults, and foreclosure sales.
On Wednesday, the Fed paused raising the bank rate. Most analysts are calling this a top in interest rates and predicting they'll head lower next year. What do you think?
I would say, because it's politically driven and next year is a presidential election year, that yes, we've probably seen a top in interest rates.
So what are your leading indicators for home prices showing you?
What they're showing right now, existing home sales are down from the peak, 40-50%, depending on the area. New home building permits are down 10-20%. Notice the defaults, mortgage defaults, they've been steadily rising. They're not up by a big percentage, but they're going up. They're not going down, which is a bad thing for home sales, I mean for housing prices. And foreclosures are flat. They're not going up and they're not going down. So all in all, I put all of those key indicators into a model, and you know, to predict prices. And the model now shows that housing prices are likely to go lower from here, not higher, based on those five key indicators.
How important is the affordability metric?
It's critical, guys. Critical. And you can prove it to yourself go look at a housing affordability chart that goes back four or five decades, or as long as you can take it back, and overlay that affordability chart with home prices. And what happens is this: housing prices go up when as housing becomes less affordable. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's the way it goes. Housing prices go down as housing prices become more affordable, which again is counterintuitive. But where you need to watch for the peak of housing markets is go back and see, okay, the market turned down, you know, in such and such a year. Where was housing affordability? It was very low. How low? It was in the, you know, 15% range, meaning only 15% of all households could afford to buy a house. Okay, and go back, you know, one boom, two boom, three booms, and you'll start to see the pattern. In each of those instances, housing affordability got in the range of, you know, let's say 15 to 20%, and that's when the market turned. And it's such a reliable indicator. It's not exact for timing, but it tells you when you're in the danger zone. And housing affordability right now is at record lows. I mean, the mortgage rates have fallen, you know, from 7% to under what was the peak? I think they're under 7 now, like 6-8 or something like that. So that'll lower the payments and make housing affordability more affordable. But nevertheless, they reached that danger zone, and you know, where it became just incredibly unaffordable. And if you go back, if you assume that the past, the futures is going to be similar to the past, which is always a good assumption to make, housing is more likely to go down than up in the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
Is continued high real inflation likely bullish for stock markets and commodities?
No, it's not. Real interest rates right now, because interest rates are kind of going down right now. But it's not a correlation. It's not a reliable correlation that you can make trading decisions or investment decisions on.
Are the aggregate of interest rate hikes showing up in the housing market?
No, they really aren't. And why interest rates went way up, and unaffordability went way up. And the reason that housing prices, you know, in most parts of the United States are now above their old peaks in all places in the United States except California, I should say, and maybe a few other areas, is supply is still the key number to watch. There's no supply on the market. There's no supply. And as I've said in previous interviews with House Street, you know, if housing demand drops 50% and supply of homes for sale drops 50%, everything's still in equilibrium, in balance. So in theory, housing prices shouldn't drop, and they don't. Like normal conditions, when you see housing demand, existing home sales drop by 50%, all of a sudden, that's a terrible situation for both the economy and the real estate market, and supply tends to rise. For some reason, it's not going up right now. It's not going up. Supply is still declining. So that's what's holding up interest rates. However, do I expect that to continue forever and ever? No, I don't. I know it's going to return to normal for some reason. Somebody's going to be forced to sell their house. A lot of people, whether it's boomers or we get into a recession and people lose their jobs or people start dying like crazy and the heirs are going to sell the people's houses, whatever the situation. People get divorced. The number of homes for sale right now is abnormally low. And one of my three key principles that you can count on in real estate is everything returns to normal, guys. When things are priced too high, they go down. When things are priced too low, prices go up. They return to normal. Supply is abnormally low. It's at record lows. That's not going to persist.
are the haves versus the have-nots a leading indicator for the economy?
No, they're not a leading indicator for anything. They're more of a reflection of the state of the economy of any given country. In the United States, for example, we have the highest percentage of wealthy people in the world of developed countries. We also have, here in the wealthiest country in the United States, we have the highest probability of people going hungry because they can't afford food. So it's really a country of extreme contrast. That's unbelievable. And, you know, I don't want to get into politics or the way we're going, where we're going things with corruption and all this, but this is kind of the way third world countries work. You have super rich at the top, super rich, and people are poor and starving to death, like Mexico, like Venezuela, like Argentina. The fact that this is occurring here in the United States is something that you know, is rather alarming. So the only people that survive on a long-term basis, that beat inflation, beat taxation, and beat changing market conditions, only 10% of the people beat those numbers. That's how hard it is to get ahead in life. I know that's not a success program for that, you know, that most people are gonna buy into, but that's a fact. And that's why I think that you know, financial survival should be taught in public schools prior to graduation from high school. You should start teaching it in anywhere from grades 9 through 12, actually 7th grade, 8th grade, all the way up through high school. Financial survival. And they don't teach it. Because, you know, I could teach people, those kids, what you have to do to get ahead. But also you can teach them what you have to be aware of. Here's what the risks are. Most people don't know what risks are, the risks that are looming out there. And that's why, you know, only 10% of the people over time, you know, beat those three factors, inflation, taxation, and changing market conditions. 10% beat it, or stay equal to it. 90% of the people do worse. And so, you know, the standard of living goes down.
Yeah, I think one of the most irresponsible ads on television is TD Trading, where this young fellow says, I don't know anything about money. Well, here, there's an app you can put on your phone and you can just trade away.
And make a fortune.
Oh, well, they don't say that. They just say, all you have to do to be successful is here. Just put an app on your phone. There you go.
See, in other words, I'm all for motivation. And that's exactly right, Jim. I'm all for motivation. But you know what? You have to be realistic. You have to scare the daylights out of people, you know, and say that there's risks out there, guys, big risks. And it's kind of like being a professional football player in the NFL. Some guys are super qualified, and they're going to be professional football players because they got the talent. They have the bodies that can withstand, you know, running into a wall at 15 miles an hour, and they don't get hurt, you know, generally. But they have to be made aware of those risks. You know, here's the risk of being a pro football player. And there's a lot of physical risk. And most pro football players, I think, are now becoming aware of those risks. They're taught about it. They see it in real life. But do they teach kids nowadays, coming up through the public school system, the risks of inflation, the risks of taxation, the risks of changing market conditions on the value on their net worth? No, they don't even talk about it at all. They just seem to think like, oh yeah, we live in America, and if you want to be rich, you can be rich. You know that, and they understate how easy it is to do. If I was running the show, I would scare the daylights out of those kids, scare them, but also they would learn the facts. Here's the risk, but here's how you can do it, guys. Let me give you some guidelines. Do this. How's the stock market do over time? It does really well over long periods of time. Okay, why is not everybody in the stock market? Because it's super volatile and it scares the crap out of you when values drop 30% because you think you're going to lose everything, which you may do. How about real estate? Real estate's cyclical too. You know, it has this, this, and this. Well, how about this? What about job security? Is college a good investment? You know, how do you learn how to be a good investor? Just start teaching them some basic guidelines for financial success and financial survival. Teach them those things, because most people are just friggin' clueless. They don't even teach them a friggin' thing. You know, what are they going to teach you in college? You know, they'd rather teach you gender studies than financial survival. How crazy is that?
Can you put together a positive case scenario where real estate prices remain the same or move higher?
Yeah, you can, that as long as you don't adjust for inflation. Now, housing prices here in the United States, on a nominal basis, which means the prices you see every day and they're not adjusted for inflation, they've actually gone up. And in most places in the United States, they're selling it at new highs. But when you adjust for inflation, that's not the case. Nope, everything's going down nationally, just a little bit. California, a lot. Like if you adjust for inflation, that in San Francisco, housing prices are down from the May 2022 peak, adjusted for inflation, probably 15%. That's a big hit, and you got to look at it that way, guys. It doesn't matter how much money, paper money, you have. It's how much goods and services will that paper money buy. That's the asset test. So you always have to adjust for inflation. Like everybody I know in California that owns a home is a millionaire or a multimillionaire. Sure. Okay. I mean, is it going to stay that way? No. No, it's not. So, you know, a lot of times, like, you know, things are just high. So you look at things like inflation hedges. What's the best inflation hedge? It's the stock market. Is real estate a good inflation hedge? Over time, it goes up like 1 or 2% above the rate of inflation. Stock market goes up 5.5 to 6%. So stock market's three times better inflation hedge long-term than real estate. Then why don't people invest more in the stock market, the ordinary man, instead of just super rich people? Because it's super volatile, and they can't handle the volatility. They get scared. You know, all of a sudden the stock market drops 500 points, or in a month it's down 20%. It scares them to death, and they don't like to be scared. Real estate, even though real estate collapses, you know, can be somewhat enormous. You know, the last downturn in the United States, I think Kay Schiller saw national housing prices in the U.S. drop, I think it was 35%. The stock market can drop 50%. And it's way more volatile. And that's the worst case situation, the worst fall in real estate we've ever seen. Stock market has had multiple times when it's dropped 40, 50%. So it takes a real education, guys. And one of the things I like to tell people is that and this line came from the author Nassim Taleb, it takes 5 years to learn how to make money and 25 years how not to lose it. And it's so true. I was at a real estate Christmas party the other day at a club here in San Diego, and their guest speakers were three people, young kids. I would say all of them were like 35 years old or younger, and they've all done, at least ostensibly, real well in real estate in the last 10 years. Not one of them has been through a bad market. Not one of them. And so I'm listening to this stuff. Wait till you guys hit a bad market. I've been around real estate cycles my entire life. You know, 7 decades worth. The good guys, the guys that make a lot of money in the good times, lose their butt and go broke during the bad times. Having three kids up there telling you, you know, how to do flips and how much money they're making and, you know, how to be a real estate developer and all this stuff and all their successes, you know, that it's all because they've been in a rising market. Wait till the downturn hits and see where these guys are, because they're not giving away money in anything, especially real estate. So it's just kind of interesting. They get the young guys up there. I won't even talk to somebody. You know, I have real estate subscribers, brokers, mortgage brokers. I won't even have a lengthy discussion or go out to lunch with a real estate agent to talk about things that hasn't been through at least two complete cycles. At least. Because you know what? You haven't earned your stripes, boys. Right? It's like, how much combat have you seen? Nothing. Oh, do I want to go to combat with you? No, I don't. I mean, if I had a choice, would I rather go to combat with you or some guy that's seen, you know, a year or two of combat? I'll take the year or two of combat. So people that haven't been through a bad market, they just don't know.
Now, if you could do a negative case on how bad it could get if interest rates go higher and credit is constricted even more.
Absolutely. And it means that mortgage credit availability is below where it was today, is below where it was at the bottom of the housing cycle in 2012 here in the United States. It's super restrictive, super restrictive. So if interest rates went higher, and if housing prices started to show weakness for whatever reason, supply starts hitting the market for whatever reason, and there's a variety of reasons. I couldn't even go through because I would just be speculating on where the supply may come from. What I'm just saying now is supply is abnormally low, and it's not going to stay abnormally low forever. And so it's going to reverse, and then all of a sudden mortgage credit availability is going to fall even lower. Because that's what lenders do. They become super loose at the top of cycles, super loose, and super restrictive at the bottom of cycles. That's what they do. And you know what? If they were into making money, they should do just the opposite. You should be more restrictive at the top and less restrictive at the bottom. But they don't think cycles or anything. They're just looking at, you know, what happened yesterday. And whatever happened yesterday is more likely to happen tomorrow, right? Right.
In a normal housing market, how many months of inventory is the rule of thumb, and where does the inventory rate stand at right now?
Normally, you go back 50, 60 years, the number of months of inventory for sale is at 6 months. That's an average. When it's above 6 months, that means there's too much inventory relative to supply, and housing prices go down. When it's below six, there's more demand than supply, housing prices go up. And that is a very, very key indicator, guys. That's why, even though I didn't write about it in my first book, Timing the Real Estate Market, it's definitely going to be included in the second book I'm putting together that I'm going to write about in the next year or two. Month supply is a key indicator to watch.
Are people still leaving California?
Absolutely. Of course they are. They're just leaving. Rich people are leaving. Rich people are leaving California. The taxes are just too great. State income tax is 13%. Like, all of a sudden, you sell a piece of real estate that you've owned for 10 years. That long-term capital gains in the United States, I think that the number of most states, United States federal income tax, I think it's 20%. In California, that they don't give you long-term capital gains. All of a sudden you sell a home and make a piece of property and make $100,000, it's not going to be taxed at 20%. It's or some fraction of 13%. It's going to be taxed at 13%. And it's probably going to get even worse because California is currently running a $70 billion budget deficit. Now, that money's got to come from somewhere. And I'll tell you, this state nickel and dimes you. I've lived in San Diego on the beach my entire life. It's amazing how they nickel and dime you on everything without doing it on income tax. I went up to the Bay Area a year ago and rented a car for a speech I was giving. Renting the car was like $35 a day. The taxes on top of renting that car were like $20 a day. It's almost the taxes are more expensive than the car. They nickel and dime you here, they nickel and dime you here, and pretty soon it takes a lot of money to live in California, not only because of the taxation, but because of the housing prices. The median priced house in California is $900,000, almost $1 million. Who can afford that? Rich people can afford that. If you don't own a house, I mean, yeah, there's certain places you can go in California where probably you can find a real cheap real estate, like the Salton Sea comes to mind. I mean, it's like the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing out there but coyotes and sagebrush. Who wants to live there? Nobody. But you can find, but anywhere along the coast that's more desirable, you're talking about almost $1 million for the median price home. So you have to move out. I tell all young kids, get your butt out of California. I don't care where you move. Move to Texas. Move to the redneck state. Because you can buy a house, a similar house in California, you know, in a desirable area, for about 30-40% what it costs in California, and you're going to make the same amount of money. And they go, well, I don't want to leave California. I don't want to leave the beach. Okay, then just sit here and suffer and rent for the rest of your life. But it is a decision you could make. I know if I was younger, coming out of college, when housing prices were like they are now, even though I grew up on the beach and I love the beach, I would move out of this place. Because you can't get ahead. You can't get ahead. And they go, oh, yeah, you can still, you know, get ahead. That's just BS. You know, that's really BS. That, you know, for somebody new, a young kid coming out of college or working a few years to buy a $900,000 house, you know, let's say you got to come up with just 10% down payment. You need 90 grand. That's 90 grand. How much income do you need to support the mortgage for that $90,000 house? I don't know, $200,000 a year. Oh, so you need $90,000 cash and a $200,000 income. What percent of all young people make that? Zero. So it's just, it's crazy. And that's why people are so upset about everything. They're unhappy. The American dream is gone, especially here in California. They know it's gone. What, you know, most of the kids, the young kids, what they're counting on is their parents dying and giving them the house. Well, you know, a lot of baby boomers, they're going to end up getting rid of their house in order to survive, because that's all they own, is a $900,000 house, and they have no income, so to speak, you know, or very little income. So how do they keep going? How do they afford the standard of living? They're going to have to downsize their house. They're going to keep their house, but they're going to have to downsize it to a lower house. And most people end up, or what they're going to end up doing is selling their house. What a lot of people in California are doing, and I get this from all my real estate agents that do a lot of volume. I say, okay, of all the listing agents, of all the properties that you list in San Diego County, what percent of those people are trading up to a more expensive home? They go 10%. 10%? I mean, that's what everybody does. They buy a better house. What are they doing? They're moving out of state. They're moving to Phoenix. They're moving to Tucson. They're moving to Denver. They're moving to Idaho. They're getting out of the state because housing prices are so high and they need the money to survive. They've got all their net worth tied up in their house, which produces a net sum of zero income for them. And they need the money. And that's why they're leaving. So I know that, you know, that, and California has, as a state, has that along with Nevada, the state of Washington, and has the lowest price appreciation, I should say highest depreciation of all the 50 states in the United States. We're doing the worst. People are leaving. They're going from high price states to low price states. Are they doing that because they don't enjoy the sunshine and beautiful weather in California? No. It's for financial reasons. Or you're really rich and you're just getting pounded with taxes. Pounded. Or you live in the Bay Area and you're getting tired of walking around human feces. There's a lot of reasons people are leaving. But it's, you know, the quality of life and the livability in this, and the far left rhetoric coming out of here is just unbelievable. Just unbelievable what they're doing. I mean, you just come and you go, why would you do that? You know, I had all the lights in my home changed from electric to LED about 3 years ago. Okay, so some of the LED lights have burned out, and I need to replace them with new bulbs. So I go down to Home Depot, and they said, oh, we don't sell that bulb anymore. I go, what? Why not? And they go, oh, California put some new restrictions on LED lights, and they're not allowed. So in other words, when that bulb burns out, I got to replace the whole fixture. And they said, yeah, that's kind of the way it is. I had to call some I had to buy them in Arizona. By having shipped to some friends of mine in Arizona the bulbs I need, because they're not outlawed in Arizona, and they had to ship them to me in California. That's how creative you have to be to live a normal life in California anymore. I mean, pretty soon we're not going to have hot water heaters or you know, gas stoves, you know, or cars, gas-powered cars, which is just a joke. I mean, but that's what everybody wants. But that's, I mean, they want you to, I just replaced all the lights LED. Now that's not good enough in California. Oh, no, it's putting a millionth of a percent of something that we don't need. So they're not allowed anymore. And, you know, you got to buy these new fixtures with these new, you know, California satisfied light bulbs. It's just a joke. It's just a joke. And I'm a California, I lived here my whole life, raised on the beach. So, I mean, I'm even considering leaving because it gets so crazy. And where am I going to move? Where are my wife and I going to move? We're going to move to the Mediterranean Sea on the coast of Greece or Italy. Same exact climate as we have here. Much lower cost of living, you know. And just said, I'm going to live in a nice place, but am I going to put up with this crap forever? All of a sudden I put something in my house, and no longer you can't replace it when a light bulb burns out? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave.
Is math an important skill for success?
Absolutely. If you can't add, subtract, multiply, and divide without the use of a calculator, you're going to have a hard time in life, guys. Hard time in life. Because you know what that is? That's just all part of having critical thinking skills. Because anytime you're doing something where a decision has to be made, you said, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? Shouldn't I do this? That in many instances, you have to be able to assess what the risks are of doing this versus that. That's all math, guys. It's all math. And if you can't do the simple mathematics, you are just, you know what? The chances of you getting ahead in life is very, very low. I was taking physical training the other day for a sport injury that I have, and my physical trainer, we were talking about how nobody understood math, and everybody's kind of laughing. And I asked my personal trainer, I said, what's 13 minus 6? She didn't know. She did not know. She became a personal trainer. I'm not a personal trainer, a physical trainer, you know, which is a medical kind of thing, and she can't do 13 minus 6? Well, what a handicap, guys. You have to learn math. You have to. And I've always been a plan B guy. Even though whatever my plan A is, I go for it 100%, but I always have a plan B. It's just like flying a fighter jet, you know. What's plan A? You know, get to the destination and drop bombs and get home. Okay, what if the engine burns out? You know what plan B is? Eject. Get away from the airplane. My plan B is, if everything I had went to hell and I needed a source of income, I would teach high school kids calculus and algebra 1, algebra 2, and calculus so they could pass the test to get into a good college if that's what they decided they want. And I would charge $100 an hour. And everybody else charges way less than that, like 50, and I would have so much business because I would make it interesting to kids how to learn it. And way I would have to, I couldn't do Algebra 1 right now, you know, if I had to. How would I learn it? I'd go to a junior college and take two courses of Algebra 1, Algebra 2, and Calculus, and I'd be up and running, and I could teach those kids how to do this. That's always my best subject, math. I'd teach them how to do it, and we'd have a good time doing it, and they'd go, I want Robert Campbell to be my tutor. This other tutor you got me, you're like, he's so boring, I feel like committing suicide as soon as he walks in the door. So, I mean, but that's my plan B. You have to understand math. It's really an important skill.
Any health and fitness tips for us?
Oh, yeah. I'm reading a new book. I'm always reading a new book on health and fitness. And I'm getting closer and closer to, you know, identifying the Holy Grail. But I'll tell you what you guys have to do. And I'm referring more specifically to men now, as I always do. You have to start health and fitness when you're 50 years old. You have to do it. And you have to do, and this is what I do, I spend 2 days a week in the gym lifting weights, and I spend 4 days a week on aerobic or anaerobic. I'm not just walking the beagles on the sidewalk. I'm out there in canyons or running hills or doing things that are anaerobically making your heart pound. You have to do that 6 days a week, guys. And why should you do that? Because your life will be so much more fulfilling. You'll be healthy, super healthy, and you'll just feel better about life. Another thing you need to do, I'm 76 years old, and people ask me, why do you keep working, Mr. Campbell? You don't need to work, and I don't need to work. You know why I work? Because it keeps pushing me forward. I can be honored to be on calls like this and continuing to work on things you love and you're good at, that's what keeps you alive. And even if you would, so people that retire, that's from the time most people retire, it's a fast trip to death. So you got to keep going. And maybe you do. Okay, let's say that I don't know how long I'm going to keep writing my real estate timing letter. I've been doing it for 23 years, and frankly, it only takes me an hour a day to do it because I'm flying on instruments. I don't have to think about it. I can do it. And you know what? I'm interested in doing some new things in my life. So I will probably continue to do this because I'm good at it and it only takes me so much time, but I'm interested in doing some new things, new endeavors that I can reach for, that I'm good at, and see if I'm going to be successful at it, but I'm going to be pushing, and not only because that it's a challenge to me, but it keeps you alive, guys. It'll make you live a long, healthy life. Than when there's always something out there that you strive for. And you have to be social when you get older. Most people, when they get older, they get away from work, their social circle gets down to zero, almost zero. So who do they have left? They have their family, their kids, and the grandkids. Well, whoop-dee-doo. You know how long that's going to be, would be interesting and exciting, you know, at least for somebody like me? Like about a month. Then I'm going to be interested in something to do. So from a social aspect, you know, I work at home. I'm not in an office. I'm self-employed. From a social standpoint, what I'm going to do is I'm going to join an over 65 softball league. I'm really good at that. And now all of a sudden, I'm competing because competition will keep you alive. And I have a bunch of group guys that I'm going to be homey with and we can have fun with. And win baseball games and that kind of thing. Not only is it physically challenging and is it satisfying to be really good at, but you're around a bunch of people. You have us guys especially, we need friends. Women, not so much. Women keep their friends. You know, that most women, they have like, you know, 3, 4, 5 times as many friends as men. We lose our friends. If you want to live a long, healthy life, you got to maintain some friendships or develop those friendships. And one of the ways I'm going to do it is I'm going to join a softball league. And, you know, all guys that know how to play baseball. And we're going to play baseball. We're going to have fun together. And we're going to compete. And it's physical. And it'll make your life more satisfying. You will be happy. And happy people live longer than unhappy, lonely people. And also, here's another thing, guys. As you get older, there's been a lot of studies done on this. Men, and this with men that are married and men that are not married, men that are not married die much younger than men that are married because they have a companion. It's that. And maybe you don't want a wife. Get a friggin' dog. Get a dog. A dog will do. For some guys, you know, maybe a dog's even better. I mean, I have both. I have a beautiful wife and 2 beagles that are crazy. And that helps keep you alive. And you know, it's just that social interaction, that friendship. But you need something else. And if you don't play baseball, or you don't play, I mean, you get to be like, you know, older, 60, 65, it's unlikely you're going to play basketball. You're probably not going to play football or soccer like Jim Goddard. What's that sport you play that's like football?
I have no idea.
Which? Rugby. Oh,
hey, well, I've never been a rugby player. That's a good way to get killed. When I was in high school, all of us football players tried out rugby, and we all ended up with concussions because we were taught how to hit in football, not how to arm tackle.
But that's a young man's sport. And,
sure,
and Jim Goddard here, he used to play hockey. You're not going to play hockey at 65 years old. You're not. Somebody's gonna clock you, and you're going to be... wish you didn't play hockey. So you got to do something else. Baseball is a good choice. I mean, do tennis. Tennis is okay. And if you really must, and I don't want to encourage this, if you can't do any other sport because you're that you know, you're that unathletic, play pickleball. It's better than nothing. So, but in, those are the things you got to do, guys, to live a long, healthy life.
Robert, where can people follow you, buy your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, and subscribe to your newsletter?
Okay, they can go to my website, realestatetiming.com. They can read about what I do. I have a blog. You can read some of my blog posts. I think you'll find it really, really, really interesting because I put a lot of time into it. Realestatetiming.com.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, who is the publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for our guests or for the show, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.